Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, I'm Monica Monday, and my co-counsel is Kristen Johnstone, and together we represent Joy Bruce. I would like to thank the court for accommodating our request for a live oral argument. Given the complexity of the issues and the precedent-setting nature of this case, we felt that it was important to have a face-to-face conversation with the court, so we appreciate that. The issue in this case is whether a man who gives his sperm to a woman who is not his wife for an artificial insemination that is performed at home is the child's legal father. Contrary to the trial court's holding, the answer is no. The trial court erred for three main reasons. First, Virginia's assisted conception statute applies. Under that statute, Mr. Boardwine is a donor, and Jeb was conceived through artificial insemination, which is specifically listed in that statute. Second, the trial court erred in finding that the parties intended by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Boardwine would be the legal father. Basing legal parentage on the party's intent is an unprecedented legal holding and an expansion of the statutory scheme for establishing parenthood. Second, it was not proven by clear and convincing evidence. Finally, there is no constitutional violation because Mr. Boardwine had not shown a full commitment to the responsibilities of parenthood, and there was an alternative method available to prove parentage, specifically the written acknowledgement.
Under the assisted conception statute, Virginia's statute deviates from the wording of the uniform statute in that it adds this medical technology.
It does, Your Honor.
Aspect. How do you address that?
Well, I mean, the Virginia legislature chose very carefully the words that it wanted. So we can't rely upon how the Big Uniform Act has been interpreted. But even looking at the words that the Virginia legislature chose, it's clear that it intended that artificial insemination, such as what occurred in this case, would be included, would be embraced within that statute.
How is this medical? I mean, if we define technology broadly, I mean, the wheel is technology. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it's technology, but how is it a common kitchen implement? How was that medical?
Well, Your Honor, and I have a long answer for that. First, I would say that the focus of the statute is not on the implement. It's not on the tool. The technology that's referred to in the statute is not a kitchen-based or a medical syringe or an injection. It's the method. Artificial insemination is the method that is chosen. Further, the word medical, as we've argued on brief, and technology are extremely broad terms. Had the legislature really intended it for it to be a physician-assisted or to occur in a medical office or a fertility clinic, it would have said so. Further, if you look at the word, like, medical is the adjective. Let's take, like, automotive technology. Clearly, changing your oil and changing your tire are some technological advances because it's a method by which you accomplish something, but I don't need an automotive mechanic to change my oil or my tire. So you don't really need a physician for medical technology.
Doesn't that write the term out of the statute, though?
It does not. It does not, Your Honor, because I think that it was used very broadly. The legislature intended that that word be used extremely broadly because otherwise it would say physician.
As broad as it might be, what could possibly be medical about this case?
Your Honor, what happened is we're writing out of the statute the term non-coital reproductive technology, which is used to the
but
equivalent.
Under the broadest
of this.
Reading of the term of the statute, what could possibly be conceived as medical about
the method itself, Your Honor? It is a method by which you bypass sexual intercourse to achieve a pregnancy. That's what the whole statute is about. It's intervening medical technology. Medical can mean having to do with diseases or injuries relating to the human body. I mean, it's an intervening method. Intervening meaning
so
not sexual intercourse.
Your argument is that anything other than sexual intercourse is medical technology?
Well, No, Your Honor, I'm saying that it's actually non-coital reproductive technology, which is explicitly listed in that statute.
But if we define this word by the company that it keeps, these other the rest of the enumerated examples are all highly technical things that involve physicians and hospital care, et cetera.
And Your Honor, we believe that the court should not resort to that particular principle of statutory construction because it applies when the words are doubtful. And here, there can be no doubt that an artificial insemination is included because it's specifically listed. And I don't think that either side...
Well, it says artificial insemination by the donor.
Correct.
Who conducted the artificial insemination in this case?
Well, the by donor language, the Mr. Boardwine contends that by donor means that the donor himself had to perform it. That actually contradicts the argument that it had to be performed by a physician. The by donor language is intended to distinguish between a sperm provided by a donor versus sperm provided by the husband, because the husband is going to be... That's exactly what is going to be protected in the assisted conception statute. So the language by donor doesn't mean that the donor himself had to perform the insemination, like Mr. Boardwine contends. It's intended to distinguish between the husband and someone who's making a gift. And that's what this case is all about. A friend making a gift. That's what donor means. I'm making a donation. That's why he is a donor under the Act. But, of course, we also have to show that it is assisted conception. And because artificial insemination is specifically listed in the statute, and because it is non-coital reproductive technology, which is also medical technology relating to the treatment of infertility, which is what we have here, it was a way to bypass sexual intercourse to achieve a pregnancy. So that's why it is included within the statute. And again, the statute focuses on the methods, not the tool. It doesn't say, you know, with a medical syringe or only in a physician's office. In fact, it doesn't say where it has to be performed, by whom it has to be performed, or with what tools. So for that reason, it's covered by the statute. Now, the trial court said even if the assisted conception statute applies, that parenthood could still be established through intent of the parties. Now,
candidly don't know what we're going to do with the first argument, but if we happen, and I'm not asking you in any way to concede this, if we happen to disagree with you on that, these are additional areas. I mean, you have to run the table on every holding that the court made, but if we happen to disagree with you, there's no reason to reach these additional grounds, correct?
That's correct. I mean, if the statute doesn't apply, then we lose. If the statute applies, then we have to win all of the other issues in order to prevail, correct?
Let me stay focused on the statute a little bit.
Yes.
The Supreme Court in Britt said that 20-156 was enacted specifically to protect the interest of married parents.
Correct.
Where does that leave us in a case like this?
It's an interesting issue, Your Honor, because in that case, we were dealing with unmarried people, and yet the court found that still the assisted conception statute applied. And so it is a bit frustrating. And
it found that it did not apply.
It found that actually that it did apply, but the father could establish parenthood through another means. So it did in fact state that it was assisted conception, and in that case as well was artificial insemination. But it did not override the 49.1 statute, which provided another mechanism by which he could establish his legal rights.
But by the plain language of the statute, I mean, that's just the Supreme Court extrapolating, but they're not, I mean, there's no preamble or clause in the statute that says married couples only need apply.
There is not, Your Honor. There is not. And so the Supreme Court has said we have two statutory schemes. One is designed to protect married people from interference from strangers. And we have another one that's to deal with people who are not married. But when you have a case that falls within the assisted conception statute, that must be analyzed first. And so I think that's why we start there. But the Supreme Court found that because Mr. Bright had such a full commitment to the responsibilities of parenthood, that his constitutional rights would be infringed if the court did not recognize the written acknowledgement that the parties had entered into, and that case is so different from our case. I mean,
I just don't see any applicability at all of Britt to this.
It's such a different factual scenario because the parties, you know, they were living together. They were a unit, albeit not a married unit. He participated actively in the prenatal care. He provided full financial support. He attended all the appointments. He put the child on his health insurance. They signed the written acknowledgement. I mean, they sent out birth announcements together. The child shared the last name of both the mother and the father. I mean, there could be no question. And I think what's troubling about this case, when you start to look about the intent, is that it's really almost undisputed, I think, if looking at the facts in this case, that Mr. Boardwine clearly wanted all the benefits of fatherhood, but not with the burdens. He did not provide financial support, except for some diapers. He attended one sonogram appointment at the invitation of the mother.
But that would change if he has declared the father.
Well, and in fact, he has been declared the father, and there's no financial support. There's been no child support paid. So this is someone who...
Well, at least theoretically, I mean, once you are declared the father, then the court may say you need to do this, that, the other.
Correct. And so he wants to be involved in the child's life. I mean, that's clear, I think, and undisputed. But to assume the burdens, I think that's what the Supreme Court was talking about, is the full commitment to parenthood. And so to say by clear and convincing evidence on this record that there was an intent by both sides that he be the legal father?
Should we construe a statute based on whether the father is paying child support? I mean, that seems to be the argument. That's the distinction.
What the trial court did here he created a new way to prove legal parentage. The intent of the parties is not an enumerated statutory method by which to prove.
Was that the attempt to bring this under that Brit kind of rubric of?
Yes, Your Honor. It was trying to find a different way because you didn't have the acknowledgement. If the assisted conception statute applied, you couldn't use genetic testing. So it was language that the court opened a door to establish a new method to prove legal parentage. And for the reasons that we've discussed, we think that is unprecedented and unworkable. And even if it is, intent was not established by clear and convincing evidence. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mundy. Mr. Rowe, and I assume that you and the guardian ad litem have worked out any sharing arrangement.
That is correct, Your Honor. Please, the court, if I could have 8 minutes, I believe the guardian would like to have 7.
Excellent. That's fine. Thank you.
Please, this court.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for having us. My name is Tom Rowe with Spiegel, Rowe, Massey, and Clay from Little Botetourt County, Virginia, and I represent Mr. Boardwine, the father in this case. And in regards to the method of how this child came about, by trying to say that a turkey baster is a medical procedure, it'd be like saying a parent putting a bandage on a child's knee is surgery. So this is not a medical technology.
Does it have to be a physician that is involved?
It could be a physician's assistant.
We have this array now of nurses, nurse practitioners, and this
correct.
And that and the other. And so as I read the court's opinion, it's pretty circumscribed to physicians as opposed to some other medical personnel.
And I believe that the medical field, when they change doctors, physicians' assistants, nursing assistants, RAs, NAs, everything, that as long as there's some kind of medical provider involved, I would argue to the court that, the legislatures, they could have left out this part about the medical aspect, but they put it in. And I'd argue that by putting it in, they required that some kind of medical assistance or medical provider or medical some kind of facility was involved.
Had the mother been taking fertility drugs
Not to my knowledge.
I thought there was some indication that prior, maybe it was in the prior attempts to become pregnant, that she had been taking some fertility drugs.
I do not recall. I would have to leave that to the record.
If that were in there, would that constitute the medical technology component of 20-156, and then we merely need to look to the artificial insemination by donor language?
I don't believe so. I believe then the mother would have been had a burden to show that actually any kind of medicine she was taking actually helped or provided the inception. So I don't believe that would apply. And in regards to the intention aspect, the mother in this case knew the father for some 20 years. They went to high school together. And in fact, in 1999, the mother went to the father and wanted him to provide sperm before, and he said, no, I'm not ready to be a father. And I think that speaks volume as to what the intention of these parties were. The mother, who has a master's degree, approached several other men, had written contracts, had all kinds...
The problem is each side had unstated or unworked out assumptions about how this was going to play out, and his appeared to be different than hers.
And I would have to respectfully disagree in that the mother brings the child to the father's house with the grandparents for his first Father's Day. So the child spends the first Father's Day with his father and with the paternal grandparents. The mother calls the father on his birthday, July the 7th, and says, we are pregnant. And then goes to the sonogram.
Clear and convincing is a pretty high bar. I mean, it's not just preponderance.
Right.
So... you know, and you would agree this is different from the Britt case in terms of the volume of facts and qualitatively the nature of the facts that we have.
Well, I believe that when you look at the photographs that were provided in the trial, when you look at hear the testimony of the witnesses, the fact that the trier of the fact was able to listen to all the parties, listen to the witnesses, hear the fact that they had Halloween parties, mother has her belly painted up like a pumpkin, they go together. The fact that the father provided a gift the day that, you know, he hears that she's pregnant, goes out and buys a gift for his child. I think all of that is basically equal to the Brit, that it's not
quite
the
same. There was evidence in the record that... the relationship got pretty frosty for an extended period of time.
They started to argue over the name and other issues. That doesn't mean he's not the father. That doesn't mean he shouldn't be declared
right.
the father.
Yes. Right.
So, and based on the evidence of the sonogram, the Father's Day visit, the exhibits, the fact that the mother had extensive experience with other folks who were not going to be involved. In this case, the father, Mr. Bordwine, was a known party to the mother. Everybody knew that he was going to be the father. This is not to protect somebody who wasn't intending to be the father. He was intended to be the father, and I would ask you to uphold the trial court.
If we accept the trial court's conclusion that it can override the 20-156 prohibitions or language by finding that it was the intent of the parties for the father to be the actual father. Are we going down a kind of a slippery slope there? Because all that would take would be for the trial court to accept the testimony of, say, in this case, the father over that of the mother. It wouldn't require anything other than, I believe the father, I find it was that requisite intent.
Well, I believe that the trial judge, when he found that 20-156 did not apply, one, from the medical standpoint, and number two, from 20-49, that the father could prove through the DNA that he was the father. And he did file a request for a paternity test that was done.
I understand, but the trial court basically got around, and it was an alternative finding. It said even if I'm wrong as to the assisted conception statute, I find that the intent of the parties overrides the provisions of the statute. Isn't that what he held?
Yes, I believe so.
Well, then back to my question. That's a pretty slippery slope, isn't it? Because it doesn't take much for a trial court to find the intent of the parties. It just has to believe the testimony of one party over the other.
Well, I believe the trial judge was trying to compare 20-49, and that was the terminology that he used. And the issue of intention, meaning that, yes, he was looking at their intention, but then there had to be something else. Was there a written agreement such as in Britt? Was there an acknowledgement? Was there a DNA? Was there other evidence? And he looked at the other evidence, just not intention.
I mean, frankly, what concerns me about that portion of the trial court's opinion is that we end up with the shoe being on the other foot, and we have mothers who are impregnated in a similar way where there is no intention on the part of the father to be a father, and we have mothers suddenly coming in asking for child support, saying, well, oh, it was the intent. It was our intent at the time that he be considered the biological father of this child.
And
how do we avoid, I mean, you asking us, or the trial court,
right,
took Britt one step beyond Britt, and how do we avoid, if we find that's a correct statement, taking it even farther and getting into a swearing contest on intent?
Well, if a mother says, we intend to have a child, and the dad says, that wasn't my intention, the courts use the DNA test. And once the father is determined to be the father, he is then obligated as the biological father. And in this case, Bordwine...
But what if the father says, wait a minute, I was relying on this assisted conception statute. I didn't think I was going to have to pay child support. And all of a sudden you're telling me, because she says I intended otherwise, I'm on the hook for that obligation.
Well, I think he has to look then whether or not there was medical procedures. Was it done by a physician, a nurse, a physician's assistant? Was it, you know, if it's an at-home scenario where there's a turkey baster, I think he loses his argument. Now, if he's in a fraternity clinic where he thinks he's just a donor who's not going to be known or not going to be responsible, then I think, you know, he would have an argument. But I think it goes back to the medical issue that this is not a medical procedure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Cargill?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Jim Cargill, and I am the guardian ad litem for the child, J.E.B., who will be 4 years old at the end of this month. Turning to Judge Petty's question that he posed to Mr. Rowe about a slippery slope, I think it could open up a slippery slope here, but instead of, as the Ms. Bruce wants to refer to this as the Virginia Assisted Conception Statute, this statute is the status of children of assisted conception. And this presentation is focusing on sperm donation. But that entire statute, when you look at later sections where it talks about surrogacy contracts that have to be court approved, it sets out a very rigid, systematic way for looking at and determining parentage. That fits in and is consistent with the legislature intending that there be medical involvement in a pregnancy resulting from artificial insemination. Any statute in Virginia that severs or establishes the rights and relationship between a child and a parent, they're very rigid and strict procedures that are followed. It does not fit with that framework that suddenly the General Assembly would intend that an at-home do-it-yourself pregnancy would suddenly be taken out of that rigid, structured approach to the establishment or severing of a child's relationship with a parent.
How do you how do you read the language in Britt dealing with the recognition that the child has an interest in all of this, that the best interest of the child is involved in this constitutional protected right of parents?
I don't think that's a new statement from the Virginia Supreme Court, because there's a prior decision, I believe from this court, talking about child support and that the interest of the mother and the father and the child are different as far as it comes to child support. And I do think it is a significant interest of the child to know who both parents are. And it's the public policy of Virginia that a child does best when there are two parents involved. Mr. Boardwine wants to be involved. He wants to be a father. He has been and is continuing to exercise rights of visitation since September of 2013. The mother had said that if the father had been providing her financial support, she would have rejected it. So you can't have it to say, well, he doesn't want to assume the responsibilities when the mother would have been rejecting them anyway. There are three parties here: JEB, Ms. Bruce, and Mr. Boardwine. Those interests can and do conflict. The statute does not apply in this situation. He is not a donor. Mr. Boardwine is not a donor as defined under the Status of Children of Assisted Conception. Mr. Boardwine then had the DNA test done that proves that he is the father. You know, that ends the inquiry, as far as I believe, for child JEB. There is no common law right of terminating parental rights. There is no common law right to enter into a contract to terminate parental rights. There is no common law right of adoption. All of those are done by statute. The General Assembly has set out how it's done. Also for the termination of parental rights in a foster care proceeding. When we look at that and look at an analysis of the status of children of assisted conception, certainly the General Assembly intended that there be medical care involvement. And that's what happened here. Ms. Bruce went to Dr. Slackman. She had attempted to do artificial insemination, and it didn't work. So she fell back on a procedure she and her former partner had used. So I think this case begins and ends with the statute does not apply. The DNA test proves he is the biological and legal father. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cardwell. Ms. Mundy?
Ms. Mundy, I'd like to kind of pose that same question to you. Britt tells us that statutes terminating the legal relationship between a parent and a child should be interpreted consistently with a governmental objective of preserving, when possible, the parent-child relationship. Why doesn't that statement itself obligate us to interpret the word medical to mean far more than occurred here?
Well, I don't think that the term medical can be interpreted differently in different cases, Your Honor. I think it has to have one meaning. And we know that we have to. He first has to clear the hurdle of that statute.
Why don't we interpret turkey baster to mean non-medical?
Because the turkey baster has nothing to do with this case. It's the method that was used. I mean, he delivered the sperm in a Tupperware dish. We're not focusing on the Tupperware dish. He wants to say that makes him a legal father. Okay. The statute doesn't talk about the tools used. I think it would be an absurd result if she had used a medical syringe, and that's covered under the assisted conception statute, but a turkey baster isn't. The statute simply doesn't speak to the tools that are used or to the place.
But we should interpret it to mean that somewhere, someone with an MD has to be involved in the process in order for the statute to apply.
No, Your Honor, and another reason why is when you look at the Uniform Act that served as the basis for Virginia's Act, there was a comment in that section that said that under the UPA, the Uniform Parentage Act, which was a separate one that Virginia did not enact, that under that particular statute, they actually required that the sperm be delivered to a physician. And so the legislature is presumed to know about that. It was part of, it was commented in the statute that we actually did adopt. So the legislature is presumed to know that you can require the sperm to be delivered to a physician and made a conscious decision not to. Now, let me turn quickly to the question that Judge Petty asked. She was taking fertility drugs, and that's at JA449. I think it's ironic that she couldn't get pregnant by going to the doctor's office, but she could when she resorted to self-help at home. I mean, I think that's a significant fact.
So much health insurance.
And with regard to the slippery slope argument, or whether this is an unwarranted expansion of the statute by going down the intent of the parties route, I would toss out another question. And I know this court is always concerned, it's not just this case, it's the next 10 that are coming right behind us. With gay marriage now, these folks are going to be looking for a way to prove legal parentage. This case, if the trial court's decision on intent is affirmed, this will become an accepted method for lots of folks to try to prove legal parentage through intent. So it does have, whether you want to call it a slippery slope or not, it has significant ramifications.
Can I ask you one final question? We have four able lawyers here, and occasionally, on rare occasions, General Assembly has a report like Boyd Graves or like the Crime Commission or whatever that sheds maybe a little contextual light on what they're trying. And I don't see that here. Am I correct? We just don't. We have the statute, and that's it. Right?
I am not aware of any legislative history, Your Honor. If there is legislative history, I'm not aware of it. I know it's fairly rare to find.
It is, yeah.
To find it, and so I'm afraid that at least this is what we believe is available.
Right.
Regrettably.
All right. Thank you very much. In keeping with our tradition, we will come down and greet counsel.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your support.
Thank you.